Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the possibility that a huge chemical plant 20 miles from Houston could explode at any moment and investigate the reasons why explosive and hazardous materials are in suburban areas of Texas, and why, after the 2013 explosion of a fertilizer plant in Ward, Texas, the requirement to make the public aware of where hazardous materials are stored was rescinded by the now governor of Texas, Greg Abbott, whose government has given the owner of the volatile chemical plant, Arkema, $8.7 million in taxpayer subsidies. An historian at the University of Houston, Dr. Robert Bozanko, joins us to explain how this industrial corridor along the increasingly vulnerable Gulf Coast, known as the Chemical Coast or Cancer Alley, because of the concentration of oil, gas, and chemical plants, came about, and the extent to which the lobbying group, the American Chemistry Council, has bought the entire Texas Republican congressional representation, along with its U.S. senators and, most of all, Governor Greg Abbott. Then we'll speak with Marco Barajas, the civil rights reporter for the Texas Observer, about the disproportionate impact Hurricane Harvey has had and continues to have on the poor and minority communities around Houston and along the Gulf Coast. We will look into the lack of zoning and regulations that allows dangerous chemical plants in urban and suburban communities, and the lobbying power of the oil, gas, and chemical industries over the electoral power of minorities in Texas. Then finally, we'll examine the firing of a group of scholars at the New America Foundation at the behest of Google, a major donor to the foundation that is using its extraordinary monopoly power and political muscle to silence researchers who had the temerity to call Google a monopoly. Jonathan Taplin, the founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, and author of Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy, joins us to discuss Google's growing dominance and his article at the New York Times, Google's Disturbing Influence Over Think Tanks. And joining us now is Dr. Robert Bozanko, who is a professor of history at the University of Houston, where he teaches 20th century U.S. history and diplomatic history. He's also one of the nation's leading authorities on the Vietnam War and the dynamics that encompassed that time period. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Robert Bozanko.
Thank you.
And Robert, I'm asking you as an historian, obviously of the Vietnam War, for example, and of 20th century American history, to be an historian of political corruption in Texas. That's your task for today, because it seems to, the more you learn about the hazardous chemicals that could explode at any moment at the plant nearby where you are in Crosby, Texas, and the political muscle that was used to prevent any oversight of this plant that could explode at any moment. They've evacuated a 1.5-mile radius of suburban homes around this plant owned by a French company, Arkema. Mm-hmm. And we're now learning that, of course, not only does it have the chemicals that they've announced that they have, but also in addition to that, apparently there are large amounts of toxic sulfur dioxide and flammable methyl propane. And the EPA was about to require the company to submit a risk management plan to the agency, which would have subjected the company to strengthening its safety rules. But those rules, which would have taken effect on March the 14th, were blocked by the new Trump EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt. And then, of course, the Texas congressional delegation have received an enormous amount of funding from Arkema through the lobbying group that they use, which is the American Chemistry Council. And we're talking about Senator John Cornyn, Republican Representative Joe Barton, Representative Pete Olson, Representative Gene Green, Representative Pete Sessions, and Representative Kevin Brady. So that's just one piece of the picture. I want to get into the history of how corrupt politics have endangered the public in Texas and exposed them to greater risks to their health and safety. But let's begin with the status on this chemical plant in Crosby. It could explode at any moment, I take it.
Yeah, I mean, like you just said, there's been a general evacuation. The story has worsened, you know, first thing this morning that, you know, there was no danger and these were organic chemicals and, you know, yet 21 people were immediately brought to the hospital. And, you know, as the day's gone on, it's gotten worse. And like you just said, now they're talking about sulfur dioxide. I mean, the whole area actually has, you know, kind of petrochemical leaching. Houston, you know, everybody thinks about oil for obvious reasons, but this is also one of the biggest, maybe the biggest petrochemical industrial area in the country as well. And so it's really a toxic a brew. And, you know, something like a bad storm can really become cataclysmic.
Well, on top of that, you know, this Arkema, a French company, has 6 production plants in Texas. And it's received more than $8.7 million worth of taxpayer subsidies from the state of Texas. So on top of exposing the citizens of Texas to incredible risks and incredible health hazards, here you have the government of Texas subsidizing these people and turning a blind eye to all of the health and safety rules that normally apply in other states and at the federal level, even though, of course, as I just pointed out, the new EPA administrator, Scott Pruitt, blocked efforts to require this plant that's about to blow up to submit a risk management plan.
Right. I mean, you know, the thing is, you know, we can look at this and call it corruption. In Texas, it's business. And with the new EPA, it's business. So, you know, they don't think there's anything corrupt about it. I hadn't known about Arkema until today, really, last night and today. But the idea of subsidizing these companies is nothing new. Oil companies get billions of dollars in subsidies. The governor, Greg Abbott, there was a terrible explosion in 2014 in West Texas. I believe it was an ammonia plant. I don't remember specifically. And after that, he actually weakened reporting rules so that now if you want to know, you know, what kind of chemicals are there, there's no mandate that they have to tell you. You can send them a letter and request, and then they can, you know, basically sit on it. So even, you know, people who would be responsible for any kind of rescues or fire departments or emergency workers might not even know what kind of chemicals are in a particular area, which seems to be the case with Arkema in Crosby, which is about 25 or so miles from downtown Houston. So this is the way things are done, especially in Texas. It's just unbridled, unregulated, you know, kind of what they would call the free market capitalism, you know, get the government out of everything and let people kind of do it their own way. And that's just the way this state is run on everything, whether it be, you know, guns, women's health, whatever. They want to basically just kind of let people do whatever they want. And in a case like this, with these, you know, kind of petrochemical and oil companies, many of which disproportionately affect lower income communities, communities of color, there's just really very little, if any, really no oversight on them at all.
And as again, we don't know when this plant, or I mean, I think it's not a question of if, because apparently they expect this Arkema plant in Crosby, Texas, to explode at any moment. But you were referring to the April 2013 explosion in West Texas, West being the name of the town,
right,
at a fertilizer company that exploded and killed 15 people. It was built right next door to an old age retirement home, which shows you that there's no rules about planning going on anywhere. And the people in the retirement home had no idea there were explosives next door to them. It was a terrible explosion. Shortly after that explosion, the Attorney General Greg Abbott, he was Attorney General, he later became governor,
right,
a year later.
Running for governor, right?
Yeah, he received a $25,000 contribution from a first-time donor to his political campaign, the head of Koch Industries Fertilizer Division, by the name of Chase Koch, who's the son of one of the billionaire Koch brothers. And then later, Abbott received more than $75,000 from Koch Industries after this explosion. So there's a direct link there. But I mean, the Koch brothers, of course, have pretty much bought the Congress. So it's not surprising they've bought these crooks down in Texas. But what is your understanding then of whether all these people in such distress who've lost their homes, etc., has any of this culpability kind of come out? Is anybody asking Abbott, why did you do this? Because the what specifically happened was that he removed the obligation for what they call Tier 2 inventory reporting. And that required all companies that were storing dangerous and hazardous chemicals to report their inventories and make them public. And normally when you have a terrible tragedy like the West explosion of the fertilizer plant, there's an outcry from the public and there's reform. Well, the opposite happened in Texas. There wasn't reform.
Right.
The Texas governor, Abbott, then rescinded the requirement to publicly post this Tier 2 information. And just yesterday, the Houston Chronicle asked the plant manager of this plant that's about to explode in Crosby, Texas, about the Tier 2 inventory, and he refused to answer what they have inside that building. I mean, and God knows, do the first responders know as well? This is, I just find this unbelievable.
I mean, by all accounts, the first responders didn't know, because today, when they got there, they were hit by this kind of this toxic stew, and many of them were sent to emergency. You know, the entire state is essentially bought and paid for by all of these big corporations, especially oil and petrochemicals. And, you know, when, like you said, when things go wrong, they don't kind of try to cover their tracks. They double down, much like Trump and the EPA does. You know, they're fairly unrepentant and uncompromising. And what you have in Texas, especially in this area here, is this massive area with intense growth. Its population's increased 25% just in the last 15 years or so. The area like that was really hit hard, Galveston, Brazoria County, Harris County, is bigger than New Jersey. And, you know, there every year, hundreds of thousands of acres, not necessarily every year, but over the course of years, hundreds of thousands of acres of great green are plowed under for asphalt. You have two dams in the west, which are both about to breach. They're doing controlled flooding and flooding neighborhoods so they don't bust, and they don't blow up, erupt. They both were rated one, which is the lowest rating by the Corps of Engineers. The bayous are inadequate. I mean, these aren't surprises. Everybody's known about this. There have been, I don't know how many studies, you know, the University, Rice University, Texas A&M, the Houston Chronicle, ProPublica did a one last year called Hell or High Water, which detailed all of these problems, which, you know, go with like this boundless development. And, you know, everybody's aware of it, but the buzzwords around here are things like innovation and all these kind of Orwellian terms, innovation and development, and that, you know, so they'll pay lip service. Oh, yeah, we have this problem, and a huge hurricane could destroy us all, but then they don't do anything about it.
So you live down there, and one of the things that I find extraordinary is that you have this incredible industrial corridor along the coast there of the Gulf, stretching across Texas and Louisiana and into Alabama and Mississippi. And it's so much of it is oil, gas, and chemicals, but it's also this incredibly vulnerable part of the country that's experiences storms and more lately superstorms and will in the future, because of global warming, be hit by even bigger storms. So describe that corridor to us, because we were talking yesterday to a wetlands specialist from the Gulf Restoration Project in New Orleans, and he was just listing some of the, you know, the Exxon plant, for example, that right there in Houston, and all of these big plants right on the coast. So describe it to us, and what's it like?
I mean, the Gulf Coast touches both Louisiana and Texas. And both states are just, you know, full of petrochemical and oil industry plants. There's a lot of offshore oil platforms in the Gulf in those areas as well. You know, in Texas, you have all the way up the coast, Houston, Baytown, League City, Pasadena, oil and petrochemical plants. And then you have, of course, the Houston Ship Channel, which is man-made. Which was cut. There's about a 25-mile cut into it, so a storm, if it ever hits that, could, you know, actually go. I mean, you could have a Category 4 storm in Houston with that. In addition to that, obviously, then all those refineries and all those chemical plants are at risk. And this storm, fortunately, in the initial surge, none of them were destroyed or damaged like the problem in Arkema is because of the flooding, which destroyed the generator, which destroyed the refrigeration, and then the backup generators got wet as well. But yeah, all along that area, I mean, it's also known as Cancer Alley in both Louisiana and Texas because Deer Park, Pasadena, all these cities, you can smell them. Like if you're driving I-10 eastward, I mean, you could smell it when you get near it because the toxic, fumes are so great. Every few years, there's a refinery explosion. There was one, I think, in Baytown not long ago where 14 people died. So it's just, a lot of these places have several EPA violations on the record. They don't do anything about them. The EPA doesn't follow through on them. And they just kind of operate in this kind of, Texas is kind of a Wild West. They see themselves that way. And that's the way they kind of conduct business here.
Well, apparently it's also known as the Chemical Coast, but you're saying it's locally known as Cancer Alley.
Both. I mean, they're not separate. Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have these toxic plants. You have very high rates of cancer in both Louisiana and Texas in these communities where these factories are, and they tend to be communities where poor people live, of course. And I mean, the people who own them don't live there. They live in like River Oaks in Houston or, wherever. And they're particularly vulnerable. Galveston is particularly vulnerable. Just got hit hard. Dixon, all of these coastal cities where there's a lot of commerce, a lot of shipping, a lot of refineries are there. And, it's only a matter of time before something much worse than Harvey hits. Ike was bad. I mean, it's just frequent here. You had, they got in it last year where the tax day floods because it happened on like around April 15th. The year before that, the Memorial Day floods. The year before that, the August floods, Hurricane Ike, Tropical Storm Allison, now Harvey. I mean, just I've been here 22 years, and, there's just constant flooding. The bayous don't hold. You can be on the road, and, and 45 minutes later, your car's underwater. Because there's just asphalt everywhere, everybody's aware of it. It's not a surprise. It's not something you can hide. Republican congressmen and businessmen all say this the right stuff, but then nobody does anything about it.
And you mentioned the wealthy area of Houston, River Oaks. Is that underwater like the rest of the city?
It probably got some water. I haven't been over there. It's a little more elevated. Houston is mostly flat, and so it's flat and it's full of concrete. But River Oaks isn't really near a bayou or any of the lower lying areas. And even if it is, they're fine. Their places will be fixed within a few weeks. There's the area near the University of Houston where I teach, the Third Ward, is predominantly working class African Americans. And that area floods easily because the Braze Bayou is right next to it. But on the other side of Braze Bayou are like million-dollar homes on McGregor Boulevard. And so both areas were probably hit equally hard. But obviously those mini mansions on McGregor will be repaired and people will move back and they'll be okay. Whereas a lot of these people in the Third Ward are, they're flooded out. And then even if they're not, their cars might be, they're going to have to deal with, stuff that got wet, mold going forward. Mold problem is horrible here under the best of circumstances. Mm-hmm. So, these people's lives are probably not going to reconstruct for who knows, if ever.
Now, have you yourself been flooded in the past?
No, I'm 52 feet up, so it's like a mountain over here. But Allen Parkway, which is less than a mile from where I am, is underwater, was underwater. The local CBS affiliate got flooded, and that happens pretty frequently here. But, I was high enough that, we didn't get any of it, and we didn't even lose power, the neighborhood where I am. And most of downtown Houston wasn't too bad. The suburbs got it way worse. Especially out west, like I-10 west area, and then the Beaumont area really got nailed, which is mm-hmm. east. It's about 80 to 100 miles east of Houston. Sure. But Houston itself, the downtown and the areas inside what's called the Loop, the 610 Loop, weren't nearly as bad.
Well, just in closing, going back to this plant in Crosby, Texas, you say 20 miles outside of Houston, that they've had to evacuate a 1.5-mile radius around it, mostly suburban homes, and already first responders have been affected by noxious chemicals. My understanding is that they could have spiked this inventory of chemicals, this organic peroxide and all this other stuff that we mentioned, that would have neutralized it. But they didn't do that because that would have destroyed the inventory in-house, which seems like a short-term, greedy and stupid thing. If the whole place is going to blow up, then you would have been better off spiking the volatile mix that's about to explode.
Yeah, I mean, I read that. I don't know anything beyond that. But honestly, I hate to say this, it's not surprising. These, you know, plants which have ignored environmental decrees and failed inspections for years and done nothing about it, only to see, you know, 15 people die, don't really have much regard for that. I think there's no planning. That's one of the funniest things when people talk about evacuation. I mean, evacuation would have consisted of saying, get the hell out of here. And there was no plan. I mean, it would have just been, you would have had this traffic, you know, this parking lot on the highways where you probably would have thousands of people dead from flooding. There's no planning, none. I mean, it's anathema here. It's really kind of cowboy capitalism. And so, you know, if that doesn't surprise me, if it's true that they refused to neutralize the toxins in that because they didn't want to lose the inventory, I think, you know, it's a simple ledger, you know, consideration for them, how much money they can save.
Well, Doctor,
so I believe it.
Well, Dr. Robert Bezanko, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Robert Bezanko, who's a professor of history at the University of Houston, where he teaches 20th century U.S. history and diplomatic history. He's also one of the nation's leading authorities on the Vietnam War and the dynamics that encompassed that time period. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the extraordinary monopoly power of Google, flexing their muscles, firing a group of researchers from the New America Foundation.
There's been a crash on the levee and mama, you've been refused. Well, it's king for king and it's queen for queen. It's gonna be the meanest flood that anybody's ever seen. Oh, mama, you're gonna miss your best friend now. You're gonna have to.
Don't you think it's sad what's happened to the water? Our water's going bad. Oceans, rivers, lakes, and streams have all been touched by man. Poison floating out to sea now threatens life on.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Michael Barajas, who is a reporter with the Texas Observer, who covers civil rights and particularly the eastern part of Texas impacted by this storm. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Barajas.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And it seems that the more reporting that we're learning about the chemical coast, we're learning about this vast industrial corridor along the Gulf Coast that is so vulnerable and will be increasingly vulnerable as these storms get more powerful, which apparently is in the cards because of global warming. So it's extraordinary that you have such vulnerability along that coast, but it's also pretty extraordinary how you also have these poor minority communities tend to be in these areas as well. And now you've got the possibility of a huge explosion in Crosby, Texas, 20 miles from Houston, because there's a chemical plant right in the middle of a suburban area, and they've had to evacuate, what, a 2-mile radius or something around that plant.
I can't speak to any degree of, I guess, specificity about the makeup of the community around Crosby, but you're right. I mean, and around the people that live typically around these petrochemical, you know, epicenters, do tend to be, you know, low income communities of color, places with limited resources. You know, some people call them fence line communities. That's what some environmentalists have come to call them. But communities that might have limited resources that, for whatever reason, haven't been bought out of their houses or haven't had the resources to move once industry encroaches. So, that's typically kind of the makeup we see in these fence line communities.
Right, but it seems extraordinary, though, when you think about the subsidies that go to these big chemical companies, and particularly the one that we're talking about now that might explode in Crosby, Texas. They've received, Arkema, have received $8.7 million in taxpayer subsidies from the government of Texas. So, do the minority communities, obviously, you've got the lobbying power of the American Chemical Council or the Chemistry Council on the one hand, and these big oil and gas companies. But on the other hand, do you not have a much political clout in these communities? Because it seems like they're not getting this $8.7 million in subsidies, are they?
Right. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you already know the answer to that question. I mean, the answer is no, of course. But all you have to do to see, I guess, maybe the evidence of that is how the industry itself is regulated or maybe not regulated. You know, this just came across my desk. I mean, the Chemical Safety Board is now saying that they're going to investigate Crosby or this plant in Crosby, the Arkema plant. You know, and we've seen a number of these type of Chemical Safety Board investigations for other accidents, tragic accidents or mishaps or, foreseeable problems at some of these facilities. And when the regulators come in and investigate and end up finding problems and fine these companies, it's usually pennies compared to what they're taking in every year, even compared to just the subsidies that they're taking in every year.
The damage continues as we speak. And what's the latest on Crosby, on whether this plant's going to explode or not?
So one thing that the Union of Concerned Scientists, they put out a statement today saying what we're witnessing is sort of the real-time confusion that comes with this kind of lax regulatory structure. I mean, the problem is we just don't know, or we're starting to learn a little bit more now that we're a couple days out of this, mandatory evacuation of the surrounding community. But, reporters, at least as far as I know at the moment, haven't been able to get an updated list of this, just the basic chemical inventory of what's there, how much of it, how's it stored, the kind of things that, the media could use to warn the public in an incident like this. You know, like I said, the Chemical Safety Board just announced that they are going to be investigating, what happened and why it happened. Among the things that they're asking for are, the chemical processes that are used at this site, the specific chemicals that are stored, used and produced, and what implications those chemicals and how they're stored have for emergency preparedness and response efforts. I mean, basically the kind of stuff that reporters have been asking for really for a couple of days now. So, there have been what's been characterized as some minor explosions on the site. I mean, we're dealing with a company right now that, doesn't want to even classify these as explosions. I mean, they're taking issue with that kind of language even. So, there was some smoke this morning. There were reports of smoke at least. I'm looking at some people that are on the ground that are closer to the scene than I am right now. And they, it doesn't look like there's any smoke right now, but, the main concern is what's still left on site, what's being done to neutralize it. I don't think anything's being done to neutralize it. I believe they're just letting it burn to see what happens, or waiting it out and keeping that 1.5 mile evacuation radius. And yeah, I guess everybody's just sort of waiting right now to see what happens.
So is Texas somewhat gerrymandered in the sense that you have minorities communities into sort of concentrated urban pockets, and then you have a lot of electoral clout in the more conservative rural districts? Is that a part of the mix?
I mean, that might be a little bit of an oversimplification. I mean, there are a couple big cases before the federal courts right now about that very issue, whether the state's sort of booming Hispanic, mostly Hispanic growth, but some in the African-American community as well, whether the state's booming sort of minority growth over the past decade was reflected in the new congressional and, you know, state House district maps that lawmakers drew. And those maps have been in the federal courts for the better part of 7 years now, because they keep getting knocked down by the courts as impermissible racial gerrymanders, or, you know, deliberate attempts to dilute the minority vote. So I don't know if that specifically answers your question, but yeah, I mean, that's an issue that Texas deals with. The parts of, you know, this storm hit a lot of different parts of the greater Houston area. So I don't think it would be appropriate to say that it only impacted, you know, or that it most heavily impacted communities of color necessarily, but low-income communities, and in Houston, those tend to be the areas of sort of minority concentration. Yeah, you can expect them to probably have a harder time recovering from this storm than some other people that have means. So,
and that comes down to insurance, right? And flood insurance, and there've been a number of floods already, haven't mm-hmm. there not? So I'm wondering, obviously, the politics of recovery are about to burst upon us with accusations against Senators Cruz and Cornyn for being hypocrites and not supporting funding for the aftermath of Sandy for the states impacted in New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut. But that aside, is there a disproportionate number of poor minority people that simply won't have the insurance?
Again, that's kind of hard to say right now. What we do know is that there are just a lot of people that don't have flood insurance, that whose homes they might not have even known they were in a floodplain. I think it was either this morning or maybe it was yesterday. The Associated Press had a story that looked at some of that data from the feds on, I guess it was maybe federal flood insurance policies, but still, as Houston, the general trend was, as Houston's population was booming in recent years, you saw the rates of flood insurance actually going down. A lot of people would say that has to do with how the county the county that Houston's in has developed in recent years. You know, structures that were put into, you know, what was never identified as a floodplain that has flooded now two or three times over the past 2 or 3 years. So there are just a lot of people here that don't even have flood insurance. But I mean, another thing to think about is the amount of people that are renting or leasing versus even homeowners. You know, with very little protections on their property, they're just in a different spot, you know, as well to consider.
Well, wouldn't the question arise, though, whether or not it makes any sense if these properties have been flooded three or four times? Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it make sense to sort of not return to them, even though there obviously is going to be a housing shortage? Will that have to be a part of this relief funding that we're talking about?
Yeah.
The insurance cost is over $100 billion, from what I understand. Those are the estimates. So it just seems sort of crazy to rebuild and have another flood in a year or two.
Yeah, I mean that's one of the questions people are asking when it comes to redevelopment and what it's going to look like here. In Texas and the parts that were affected by this storm. I mean, there's also just a larger conversation to be had about what development looks like in the era of greater, higher intensity storms that hit with more frequency, which, you know, scientists have connected to climate change, and in a rapidly growing urban area where there's been major development over swaths of the floodplain that experts would say used to absorb a lot of this water or used to really control some of the runoff. And now you've got pockets of what they call, quote, urban flooding. So, yeah, I think officials in the Houston area are going to have it'll be interesting to see what the discussion is in public after this, you know, how much of it they're willing to engage with, whether there need to be some type of zoning regulations, whether there need to be changes in how the flood control district out there assesses development and decides what is or isn't prone to flooding. how they even assess this, how they even, you know, use this system for assessing what is or isn't in the floodplain. I mean, there are people are saying that this was a, quote, 500-year storm that hit Houston, or maybe even greater, which means there should have been a 1 in a 500 chance that it would hit on any given year. You know, just last year, the same area got hit by another similarly rare storm. So if these things are hitting with that amount of frequency, what sense does it make to call these 500-year flood events or 100-year flood events? Or it's almost like the language around this needs to change some, too. So,
right. Well, yeah, Michael, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate your time.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Michael Barajas, who is a reporter with the Texas Observer, who covers civil rights and the area of East Texas impacted by Hurricane Harvey. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jonathan Taplin, founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, where he specializes in international communications management and digital media entertainment. He began his entertainment career as tour manager for Bob Dylan and the band and produced Martin Scorsese's first feature film, Mean Streets. He went on to produce television documentaries, including The Prize and Cadillac Desert for PBS, and 12 feature films, including The Last Waltz, Under Fire, and To Die For. His latest book is Move Fast and Break Things, How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, Google's Disturbing Influence Over Think Tanks. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Taplin.
Good to be here, Ian.
Well, thank you, John. And tell me about, or tell our audience about what's at issue here with the New America Foundation, who, by the way, their scholars are frequent guests on this program. So I find them to be a useful resource.
Yeah. So New America Foundation funded a group inside there called the Open Markets Group, which was headed by a guy named Barry Lynn. And they were the most important group of scholars looking at monopoly in America and how the increasing concentration of business power has increased, not just in the tech sector, but all over the economy, whether it's airlines, pharmaceuticals, wherever. And the Open Markets Group put out a statement after the European Union sanctioned Google with a $2.7 billion fine a few weeks ago. And they put out a statement applauding the EU and saying that American antitrust regulators should follow their example. And Eric Schmidt, the executive chairman of Google, who provides most of the financing for New America Foundation, was incredibly angry about this and essentially told the leader of New America, Anne-Marie Slaughter, that she had to get rid of the Open Markets Group. And she then wrote Barry Lynn an email saying that they had to leave by September 1 and essentially fired them. And this is exactly the kind of political pressure that Google applies all over the world in terms of on not just academic institutions, but think tanks and others in order to keep the political narrative in their favor and not have people who oppose them.
Well, and this is the company that whose motto is don't be evil, but the importance of the significance here is that think tanks, and they are obviously on the right and on the left, and I think you could fairly say that the New America Foundation is a centrist think tank, but by and large they're about intellectual inquiry. So this is a big issue, isn't it, in that sense, you know, of anti-intellectualism. Surely we have enough anti-intellectualism with the Trump administration without Google adding to it.
Well, I mean, what's especially disturbing is that, you know, the role of think tanks is underappreciated in terms of how they play a role in kind of the Washington consensus and how opinion is created both for legislators and regulators. And so by having such influence on the people who write these papers that are then read in the committees and things like that is really a kind of problematic action. And here's the thing. The Wall Street Journal did a survey and showed that Google was spending $2 million a year paying academics to write papers that would be favorable to Google's position and basically saying Google is not a monopoly. And they even went so far as to pay Judge Robert Bork shortly before he died to write a paper saying that they weren't a monopoly when they were in trouble with the Federal Trade Commission. And some of that money is dispensed through think tanks, and some is just paid directly to academics. But out of that input since 2009, they got 100 papers from academics that were favorable to them, and they got 100 papers out of think tanks that were favorable to them. And this is their way of kind of currying influence through dominating the communications channels of Washington, D.C.
Well, Eric Schmidt, who is the biggest funder of the New America Foundation and one of the top executives at Google, I understand that during the Obama administration, he was the number one visitor. He was logged in more times to the White House than any other single person in the entire 8 years of the Obama administration. So this is a man who clearly understands how to wield political clout in Washington.
Yeah, I mean, there's a whole chapter in my book called Google's Regulatory Capture, and essentially, not only did Schmidt visit the White House more than any other CEO by a long shot, but then Schmidt put people from Google into the various agencies in the Obama administration. So the person who ran the patent office was formerly the person who ran Google's patent practice. The person who was the assistant attorney general for antitrust in the Obama administration was the person who had been Google's antitrust attorney. You know, Google had people high up in the Federal Communications Agency. So it was pernicious. It was everywhere. In the White House Office of Technology Policy was run by two Google people. So there was a kind of revolving door between Google and the government. And what's astonishing is one could say, well, okay, Eric Schmidt is a liberal and he was helping Hillary Clinton. But literally the day after Clinton lost, he was out there communicating with Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner in the hopes of getting in bed with Trump. And by the way, not only did he extend invitations to them to come to his conference in Italy, but he also went to the White House and railed on about how Trump was going to be a great help to the economy with all his new initiatives. So it's very clear he has hardly any political conscience whatsoever. He's just going to go where the money is.
Let's talk about your book and the extent to which it has started a debate in a number of newspaper columns, and there's been a pretty robust response to your article in Thursday's New York Times, Google's disturbing influence over think tanks, not the least of which is a denial by Anne Marie Slaughter, former State Department official under Hillary Clinton, now the head of New America. It sounds like you're getting under Google's skin.
I think I am. You know, it's funny. When the book was published, it was seen as the ideas that I was calling for, which was a renewed antitrust scrutiny of these large tech companies like Google, Amazon, and Facebook, was seen as kind of an outlier. And today, more and more people on both sides of the political aisle are saying this needs to come out. I mean, Elizabeth Warren yesterday tweeted that what Google did to the Open Markets Group was really wrong and was disturbing. And quite honestly, I see this coming from both the right and the left. I mean, Orrin Hatch has said that, you know, these big tech companies are too powerful. And Cory Booker and Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar have been critical of them. So I have a sense that something essential is changing here, and that people are understanding that political power, when you have companies that have so much money and so much influence on our culture, are causing problems, and not the least of which was, you know, the problems that are caused, you know, when these platforms like YouTube and Facebook are really the way that fake news gets deployed throughout the country.
Along with real news, I think something like 3/4 of Americans get their information from Facebook and YouTube. So
right.
That is a huge problem. And as we know, Stephen Bannon and the Mercers used the targeting, micro-targeting, in their campaign to defeat Hillary Clinton very skillfully, using social media with fake news, using Russian bots to amplify their effect. But you mentioned the power.
Can I give you a little factoid that I just learned today from
Sure.
someone in the intelligence community, which is that Eric Schmidt's daughter worked for SCL, which is the company that controlled Cambridge Analytica, as an intern.
Really?
So that is a very strange little crossover for political facts,
covering your bets, yeah. And Cambridge Analytica, of course, is the company
exactly.
that Mercer owns and that Steve Bannon's on the board of. That
right.
that were really, I think, in many ways, probably more responsible than anybody else. Although, you know, you can include the Russians and Hillary's terrible campaign and the FBI director.
They couldn't have done what they did if there hadn't been these two open platforms, Facebook and YouTube, in which, you know, you could totally manipulate this stuff, and there was nobody at the control of these platforms to stop this fake news. I mean, if you think about it, YouTube, for instance, there is no pornography on YouTube. So that means that YouTube has very sophisticated artificial intelligence that blocks pornography from being uploaded. So when someone tries to upload porn onto YouTube, it gets sent off into a separate queue and a human looks at it, and if for some reason it happens to be a National Geographic ethnographic video, maybe it gets uploaded, but the rest of it just goes in the trash. Well, they could do that with all sorts of things. They could filter out the 44,000 ISIS propaganda videos that are on YouTube. They could filter out a lot of the fake news. I mean, if someone's putting forth an article that says the Pope endorses Donald Trump, it wouldn't take a whole lot of artificial intelligence energy to understand that that is not true. And so, I mean, these platforms are just the way in which Bannon and Cambridge Analytica was able to do their deeds.
Well, but when you mentioned a minute ago Google being a rich company, that's an understatement. I think it's about the richest company in the world and in the history of the world. So give us a context here compared, say, to ExxonMobil and other big international, multinational companies.
Okay, so 10 years ago, the largest corporations in the world were General ExxonMobil, Shell, Citibank, companies like that. Today, the largest companies in the world are Apple, Google, Amazon, Microsoft, and Facebook. In other words, the five largest corporations in the world are all tech companies when you do it by market capitalization. So pretty soon, maybe in the next 2-3 weeks, Apple will be worth $1 trillion, and Google is moving close to being worth $800 billion. So, I mean, that's probably larger than the economies of 2/3 of the countries in the world, maybe 3/4 of the countries in the world. So, I mean, these are sovereign states, and they act that way. They don't want anybody to interfere with their corporate behavior, and so they're just kind of charging ahead.
And so let's then compare this situation we're in now with the monopoly power of Google, Amazon, Facebook, and Microsoft, the biggest corporations in the world, and Apple. And we also know that, for example, they park their profits offshore, so they don't pay taxes, in spite of, at least that's the case with Apple, and I'm not sure about the others. So
no, they all use the same.
Oh, they probably do, yeah. So
They all use the same tricks to shelter their profits.
So they're not as virtuous as they'd like us to think in terms of paying their fair share to the government coffers. But let's compare this then, since we've made the comparison with ExxonMobil. How does this relate, to example, the breakup of the big antitrust breakup under Teddy Roosevelt of Standard Oil? Because it seems to me that at the end of the day, that's what's necessary. These are powerful monopolies, and they have to be broken up.
Well, it's very similar. I mean, if you think about it, people say, use the word, data is the new oil, right? So what is Google or Facebook but a data extraction organization, just in the same way that Exxon or Standard Oil was a oil extraction? They take your data, and you, the average millennial, spends 2 hours a day on Facebook, and that's free labor for Facebook to help them manufacture profiles of those people that they then sell to advertisers. Now, when they basically do that, they control a very scarce resource, which is between Facebook, Google, and Amazon, they control more data on more people in the world than any other corporation in the world. Now, when Teddy Roosevelt said, okay, Standard Oil has 80% of the oil business in the United States, and that's too big because it make sure that nobody else can compete with them. Well, Google controls 88% of the search advertising business in the United States and 91% in the rest of the world. Nobody else can compete in that game in selling search advertising and selling search. And Facebook controls about 75% of the social media business when you include Instagram and WhatsApp, which are companies that Facebook owns. So these companies have extraordinary monopoly power, and they're exercising. So if you think of a company like a small LA company that tried to compete with Facebook in the social media sphere called Snapchat, so they had some very innovative features. It's called Snapchat Stories. Facebook, they were starting to get a lot of traction, and Facebook offered to buy them for $3 billion, they turned Facebook down, and Facebook said, well, you made a big mistake in turning us down. And so Facebook essentially ripped off Snapchat with every feature they had, and now it's called Facebook Stories and Instagram Stories and WhatsApp Stories. They didn't even bother to change the name of it. And Snapchat went public at $28 a share, and its stock is now at $13 a share. So they just basically almost put them out of business. So, I mean, this is the way monopolies act. They act like bullies, and that's exactly what happened yesterday to the kids at New America. The the bully didn't want them to be writing about Google and calling them a monopoly, so they got rid of them.
Well, given the analogy between breaking up the trusts, the Standard Oil Trust, in the beginning of the 20th century under President Roosevelt, and the need to do so at some point or other because of Google, you said that 10 years ago, ExxonMobil was the biggest corporation on the planet, and now, 10 years later, Google is. So in 10 years' time, where will Google be if it's not restrained?
Well, it'll be a lot bigger than it is now, because Google is moving into many other kinds of businesses, just as we see Amazon moving into the grocery business. So Google is going to move into the transportation business with the autonomous car patents that it has owned. It's going to move into the medical information business. There's nothing that's going to stop Google from getting bigger, because, quite frankly, this is what economists call a market failure. There is no venture capitalist who's going to fund a company to go up against Google in the search advertising business. It's just not going to happen. So there's no market solution to this, and that's why ultimately it's only the government that can come in and say that this is important, that this concentration affects our economic well-being. It means that fewer people can start up new companies if all this concentration. More and more services are getting merged into these companies. They certainly are going to own the artificial intelligence business because they have all the data. And it essentially means less freedom for Americans, in the sense that fewer and fewer companies are competing for our labor. And so, you know, that allows the employers to gain more power over how we do business and what we do. So, I mean, I think we have to kind of stop this now. We have to bring, because these companies are only going to get bigger. As, you know, nobody even put up a fight about Amazon buying Whole Foods the other day. And, you know, watch what Amazon does to the rest of the grocery business, just the way they've kind of made the business of being a retailer. Like Sears and Kmart are probably going to go bankrupt this year, and they blame it on Amazon.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Good to be here, Ian.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Taplin, founder and director emeritus of the Innovation Lab at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California, where he specializes in international communications management and digital media entertainment. He began his entertainment career as tour manager for Bob Dylan and the band, and produced Martin Scorsese's first feature film, Mean Streets. He went on to produce television documentaries, including The Prize and Cadillac Desert for PBS, and 12 feature films, including The Last Waltz, Under Fire, and To Die For. His latest book is Move Fast and Break Things: How Google, Facebook, and Amazon Cornered Culture and Undermined Democracy. And he has an op-ed at the New York Times, Google's Disturbing Influence Over Think Tanks. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.